Will both sides finally agree to a deal to end the war in Gaza?
The next important step is for Hamas to say yes, and then in the coming days, for all of the expert negotiators to get together to work on clear understandings on implementing the agreement.
Plus, Joe Biden passes the torch.
She'll be a president respected by world leaders because she already is. She'll be a president we can all be proud of. And she will be an historic president who puts her stamp on America's future.
And later, Ukraine pushes forward in Kursk. Mpox is on the rise in Africa. And we'll meet a North Korean defector who is helping others get their stories out. Today is Tuesday, August 20th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish, along with Lori London. As we mentioned on Monday's show, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken is in the Middle East trying to resurrect peace talks between Israel and Hamas, hoping for a deal that will return Israeli hostages being held by Hamas and bring about a ceasefire in the war that has raged since October 7th. Late on Monday, Blinken had good news to share. He announced that Israel has confirmed its support for a deal, and he urged Hamas to back the proposal as well, saying it would help alleviate the dire humanitarian situation in Gaza. VOA's Veronica Baldaris Iglesias reports.
Israel is on board with a proposal presented last week that bridges the remaining differences to reach a ceasefire in its war with Hamas. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken made the announcement Monday after holding several meetings with top Israeli officials.
The next important step is for Hamas to say yes, and then in the coming days, for all of the expert negotiators to get together to work on clear understandings on implementing the agreement.
Pressure is building on the government of Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to secure the release of Israeli hostages taken by Hamas on October 7th. Blinken conveyed to him the importance of reaching a ceasefire agreement now.
With every passing day that there's not an agreement, two things can happen. One is, of course, more hostages can perish. And second, intervening events come along that may make things even more difficult, if not impossible.
Blinken said he brought up the urgency of addressing the humanitarian situation in Gaza when he met with Israeli Defense Minister Yoav Gallant. Discussions also included the possible reemergence of polio in the Gaza Strip. Palestinian health officials reported a case last week in an unvaccinated child. Again, Secretary of State Blinken.
We've been working on a detailed plan to make sure that those who need to be vaccinated against it can get vaccinated, and we're working with the Israeli government on that.
Blinken expects to learn Hamas's stance on the bridging proposal when he meets Tuesday with mediators from Egypt and Qatar in the coastal town of El Alamein, Egypt. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News.
On Tuesday in Egypt, Blinken met with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi and the Egyptian Foreign Minister Badr Abdeldadi. Egyptian security sources said further ceasefire talks in Cairo this week were contingent on an agreement over a security mechanism for the so-called Philadelphia Corridor between Egypt and Gaza. The U.S. has proposed an international presence there for a limited time.
Meanwhile, in Chicago, the Democratic National Convention got underway Monday night. It was supposed to be for Joe Biden as he was campaigning for a second term. That was before he made the historic and difficult decision to bow out of the race and endorse Kamala Harris. So Biden's speech was more of a farewell to the faithful as he passed the torch to a younger generation of politicians. VOA's White House Bureau Chief Patsy Wiedekuswara has more from the convention.
Introduced by his daughter Ashley, President Joe Biden received a hero's welcome. At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, Illinois, he fulfilled his promise to be a transitional leader.
Are you ready to elect Kamala Harris and Tim Walz?
And gave his full support to Kamala Harris, the party's new presidential nominee for the November election.
She'll be a president respected by world leaders because she already is. She'll be a president we can all be proud of. And she will be a historic president who puts her stamp on America's future.
Biden was unchallenged at the Democratic primaries. Just a month ago, the roughly 4,000 delegates here were set to nominate him. But Monday, he balanced support for Harris and his achievements in office.
COVID no longer controls our lives. We've gone from economic crisis to the strongest economy in the entire world. Record 16 million new jobs. Record small business growth. Record high stock market. Record high 401ks. Wages up. Inflation down, way down, and continuing to go down.
It started with a debate against Republican nominee former President Trump in late June. Biden, who is 81, had such dismal performance that people questioned his mental acuity. Then an assassination attempt on Trump that rallied Republicans and pushed him further ahead in the polls. For weeks, Biden insisted he would remain in the race, even as party leaders privately asked him to step aside. Thomas Schwartz, presidential historian at Vanderbilt University via Skype.
Joe Biden is a one-term president who was forced off the ticket by the leaders of the Democratic Party despite having won the nomination in the primaries. He's now asked to make an enthusiastic endorsement of his vice president, Kamala Harris. It doesn't take a Sigmund Freud to realize that he might be very conflicted about this.
If he's conflicted, Biden did not show it, displaying strong support for Harris, basking in the love and gratitude from his party. We spoke to some delegates here on the floor.
It was a beautiful speech. It was a great speech of a culmination of years and years of service.
Well, I think his legacy is strong and positive. And tonight he told the American public why he loves them and what he did for 50 years to serve our nation. And it's an incredible record.
This despite Trump trying to sow division among Democrats.
They forced him out. It was a coup. We had a coup. That was the first coup in the history of our country.
Biden repeated Democrats' theme of Harris, a former prosecutor, going against Trump, who has been found guilty in court.
And crime will keep coming down when we put a prosecutor in the Oval Office instead of a convicted felon.
Biden ended his speech with an embrace from Harris, cementing his role among Democrats as the leader who could possibly save the country again from Trump, this time by passing the torch.
Joe, thank you for your historic leadership, for your lifetime of service to our nation, and for all you will continue to do. We are forever grateful to you.
Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, Chicago.
In other election news, on Monday, the United States accused Iran of launching cyber attacks against the campaigns of both U.S. presidential candidates. Additionally, the U.S. alleges Iran targeted the American public with influence operations aimed at spreading discord and increasing divisiveness. Devi Rajaram of Reuters has that story.
U.S. intelligence officials say Iran is to blame for cyber attacks on both American presidential campaigns. On Monday, the FBI and two other agencies said in a joint statement they had seen increasingly aggressive Iranian cyber activities this election cycle. They also said Iran had carried out influence operations to fan political divisions and, quote, cyber operations targeting presidential campaigns. It backs up charges made by the campaign of Donald Trump earlier this month that Iran had hacked one of its websites. Those accusations triggered an FBI investigation. Trump at that time said Iran was only able to get publicly available information. Officials also say that Iran targeted Kamala Harris's campaign ahead of a Democratic presidential nomination acceptance this week. They revealed that Iranian operatives used social engineering to access key campaign figures, leading to theft and leaks aimed at swaying the election. Iran's mission to the UN dismissed the allegations as unsubstantiated, insisting it has no intention or motive to interfere in the U.S. presidential election.
Reuters' Devi Rajaram reporting for us today.
Russian forces continue their push toward Pokrovsk and have expanded their aerial assaults to include Ternopil in Ukraine's west. The big news, however, remains Kyiv's gains in the Russian region of Kursk. Anna Chernikova has an update from Kyiv.
President Volodymyr Zelensky confirmed that the Ukrainian Defense Forces control more than 1,250 square kilometers of Russian territory and 92 settlements in Russia's Kursk region. According to Zelensky, this operation is the biggest investment in the process of freeing Ukrainians from Russian captivity. He noted that Ukraine captured the largest number of Russian prisoners in one operation, which is one of their main goals. Zelensky also noted that if the West had not imposed restrictions on the use of weapons on the territory of Russia, Ukraine would not have needed a physical intervention into the Kursk region to protect Ukrainian citizens in the border areas and destroy the potential for Russian aggression. Meanwhile, Russian forces are getting closer to the city of Pokrovsk. Local authorities there continue the evacuation of residents, estimating there are less than 2 weeks left until Russian troops capture the city. Reportedly, Russian forces have taken control of the village of New York near Toretsk. However, there is some dispute as Ukrainian military reported the presence of the Ukrainian troops remaining on the outskirts of the village. Meanwhile, Russian forces continue the missile and drone shelling across Ukraine. In the early hours of Tuesday, a Russian missile attack hit energy facilities in the Sumy region, leaving almost 19,000 people without electricity. The rescue operation and repair works are ongoing. Also, Russian forces targeted the Ternopil region in western Ukraine, hitting an industrial facility. Authorities there reported that storage containers with fuel and lubricant materials caught fire, resulting in dangerous levels of harmful chemicals, particularly chlorine, in the air. Residents are advised to close the windows and avoid outdoor gatherings. Anna Chernikova, VOA News, Kyiv.
As we heard from Anna, Ukraine is making progress in its incursion into Kursk, catching the Russians off guard. But what does it mean going forward? Laurie caught up with Doug Klain. He's a non-resident fellow and policy analyst at the Atlantic Institute.
Absolutely, this signifies a dramatic shift in the war. Western observers have spent months, maybe a year or so, thinking that this war has devolved into stalemate, into positional warfare rather than maneuver warfare, that Ukraine and Russia may now be stuck in trenches with full visibility of the battlefields thanks to drones and surveillance, and that no side could really do something big and shocking. Ukraine has proved that those assumptions were false. Ukraine took Russia and the West completely by surprise with this incursion into Kursk. Ukraine moved quickly and did something approaching combined arms maneuver, which is one of the most difficult things to do in warfare. And the Ukrainians failed to do it during their large-scale counteroffensive last year, but they were quite successful in moving quickly, exploiting a gap and taking territory this time. It's something that is likely to inspire more confidence among Ukraine's backers in the West, especially U.S. lawmakers and the public want to back a winner. And this is something that may renew energy in Washington for deepening support for Ukraine.
President Zelensky said that if he was able to have used Western weapons deeper into Russia, that they wouldn't have needed to do that. Do you think that's really the case? Or because they are able to use some.
This has been one of the key asks that Ukraine has had of the United States in particular for months. The U.S. finally lifted some restrictions on using U.S. weapons inside of Russia when the Russian forces launched their Kharkiv offensive earlier this year. The Russians were pounding Kharkiv especially, but Ukrainian civilians overall with glide bombs, which are incredibly difficult to intercept once they've been launched from their bombers. Ukraine needed first to be able to intercept those bombers before they've dropped these glide bombs. And now the U.S. has lifted some restrictions for Ukraine to do that in some cases. But what Ukraine really needs to be able to do is use these long-range missiles that the U.S. and other allies have provided to take out the military airfields where those bombers are sitting like ducks on a perfectly clean tarmac. Once Ukraine is able to actually take out the Archer and not have to keep defending against the arrows, that is something that will make it much more difficult for Russia to keep prosecuting this war. That change has still not happened, and Ukraine is pushing very hard for it.
This has to be quite an embarrassment for Russia.
The incursion into Kursk? Absolutely. This is the first time since World War II that a foreign power has invaded onto Russian territory. And that is something that has happened on Vladimir Putin's watch. And it is something that will be, you know, I'm sure, a permanent stain on his legacy, along with the laundry list of other stains on his legacy. You know, this is something that took them completely by surprise. We're still kind of waiting to see just what the domestic reaction is inside of Russia. You know, there have been some mixed reactions, but certainly for the Russian residents of Kursk who have had to evacuate en masse, you know, this has been a catastrophe.
It's one thing to watch your country invading its neighbor, and it's another to have it turned on you. Although I think Ukraine is doing its best to avoid civilian casualties still, this is a frightening experience now on the other side of the border.
War is a frightening experience for anybody who is caught up in it. And Ukraine, for its part, by all indications and reports, is following international humanitarian law during its incursion into Kursk. Ukraine is prosecuting this war in a very different way from how we've seen Russia prosecute it and persecute Ukrainian civilians. There was an excellent Washington Post report where Washington Post journalists this past week accompanied Ukrainian forces into Kursk and met with Russian civilians that were there and asked them how things were going and recorded things. You know, they saw Ukrainian forces distributing water and other humanitarian aid and supplies for people who had no power and needed food. There was a fascinating interaction that the journalists recorded where one Ukrainian soldier from occupied Crimea was interacting with some Russian civilians who said, "Why are you doing this? We're just innocent civilians. You know, you guys shouldn't even be here." And, you know, the Ukrainian responded something to the sense of, "You know, I used to think that too when I was still a civilian, and then you guys came and took my home from me."
That's Lori. She was speaking with Doug Klain, a non-resident fellow at the Atlantic Institute. And we're also learning that Germany has issued an arrest warrant for a Ukrainian national in connection with the explosions that damaged the Nord Stream gas pipelines that carry natural gas from Russia to Western Europe. At question is whether the Ukrainian government was involved in the 2022 attack, which many say contributed to a global spike in inflation. We're keeping an eye on this developing story. Check voanews.com for more.
You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Lori London, along with Steve Karish here in Washington. Cases of mpox are on the rise, particularly in Africa. We'll be hearing from the WHO in a moment, but now to the Democratic Republic of Congo and how it's addressing the deadly outbreak, which is surging across Africa. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn reports.
The Democratic Republic of the Congo hopes to receive its first doses of an mpox vaccine next week, following promises from Japan and the United States to help fight its outbreak. That's according to Congolese Health Minister Samuel Roger Kamba Malamba on Monday.
I hope that the vaccines will arrive next week. You know, it's really a whole logistics chain, from our acceptance first, and then a few administrative procedures before shipment. But our strategic vaccination response plan is already ready. We're just waiting for the vaccines to arrive.
Earlier on Monday, Japan's Ministry of Health, Labor, and Welfare said in an email statement to Reuters that it was preparing to provide Congo with mpox vaccines and needles in cooperation with the World Health Organization and other partners. Their arrival would help address a huge inequity that left African countries with no access to the two shots used in a 2022 outbreak, while the vaccines were widely available in Europe and the U.S. Global vaccine group Gavi said last week it had up to $500 million to spend on getting shots to impacted countries. The DRC's health minister said, quote, "Gavi has offered to make the vaccines available, and we agreed." The World Health Organization declared Mpox a global public health emergency last week for the second time in 2 years, as new variant Clade 1B spread rapidly in Africa. The DRC has 16,700 recorded cases and over 570 deaths, the health minister said.
That was Christy Kilburn with Reuters.
And as cases of Mpox continue to spread, World Health Organization Regional Director for Europe, Hans Klug, addressed the reality of what this new strain is and is not.
Mpox is not the new COVID. Regardless of whether it's Mpox Clade 1 behind the ongoing outbreak in East Central Africa or Mpox Clade 2 behind the 2022 outbreak that initially impacted Europe.
The new variant of Mpox has triggered global concern because it seems to spread more easily through routine close contact. A case of the variant linked to the growing outbreak in Africa was confirmed last week in Sweden.
And finally today, a group of North Korean defectors in Seoul have started a news website aimed at exposing North Korean human rights abuses. They also want to provide a more nuanced perspective about their homeland. VOA's Bill Gallo has details from the South Korean capital.
When North Korea appears in global newscasts, it's usually scenes like this that dominate. The country's leader, Kim Jong-un, overseeing a weapons test. But those kinds of martial images obscure much of what's really going on in the country, says North Korean defector Lee Song-min.
North Korea is more than nuclear defense and Kim Jong-un. There is a lot of people with different perspectives and different hopes and goals for the future of their country.
Lee fled North Korea in 2012. He now helps run a website called NK Insider, whose goal is to elevate North Korean voices.
A lot of people are talking about North Korea, like the scholars or experts, but there are certain differences when you hear the voices of North Koreans who lived there in that system.
About 8 North Korean defectors write for the website, launched earlier this year. They communicate secretly with sources inside North Korea for their reporting. Some don't want to appear on camera. Zane Han, a former Pyongyang resident, fled North Korea just 2 years ago.
Nobody can imagine what the situation is like inside North Korea, what the people experience inside North Korea, really as a slave inside North Korea. But I was there, I know.
Han is one of very few North Koreans to recently make it to the South. That's because North Korea has tightened border security since the pandemic. Until last month, Lee Shin-hwa was South Korea's ambassador for North Korean human rights.
It's getting more and more difficult to see the new defection from North Korea. The ordinary North Korean people's chances, I think, almost like a zero.
He says one of his goals is to speak for North Koreans who have no voice and cannot leave.
To give a platform to North Korean defectors, and by extension to those who are still living inside North Korea.
Doing what he can to provide a more nuanced perspective of his homeland. Bill Gallo, VOA News, Seoul, South Korea.
And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of Lori London and all of us here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with a 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.